Hello, I'm Lily Hoyam.
And I'm Gordon Johnston. Welcome to the Last Question podcast, brought to you by the Data Lab, Scotland's Innovation Centre for Data and AI, hosted by the University of Edinburgh. As always, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a review or a rating on whatever platform you listen to the podcast on. Some people started doing it and we really appreciate it, and it just helps bump us up the algorithms. And as a thank you for all of our listeners, towards the end of the episode, there'll be a code for 25% off tickets to this year's Data Summit being held in Edinburgh on the 2nd and 3rd of November, which features lots of cool people that you've heard on the podcast, like Paolo Benanti, Olga Tokariuk, and today's guest. So keep an ear out for that.
Yes, today we are delighted to be talking to Vivian Parry. Vivian is a writer and broadcaster, a scientist by training, and hosts medical programmes for BBC Radio 4 and writes widely on health and science topics. Vivian also has a part-time role as head of engagement at Genomics England, which delivered the 100,000 Genomes Project.
Yeah, the 100,000 Genomes Project was a British initiative to sequence and study the role our genes play in health and disease. And that's what we're going to be talking to Vivian about today. We'll touch on genetic sequencing, epigenetics, AI, and some of the ethical considerations that are arising as we expand our knowledge of how genetics works. But before all that, Lily, what are your favourite genes?
Deoxyribonucleic acid washed.
So, on to the interview. Vivian, thanks for joining us.
It's not a bad joke, actually.
No, it's actually pretty good.
Yeah. Is that better than just saying acid washed? Because it makes the punchline clearer.
I think it's funny.
Yeah. I do too.
So, thanks so much for joining us, Vivian.
Delighted to be here.
To start with, can you tell us a bit about the 100,000 Genomes Project and what advancements have been made in genomics since then?
The 100,000 Genomes Project was an Olympic legacy. So back in 2012, it was announced by David Cameron, who you may remember had a child with a rare disease who sadly died, that 100,000 genomes were going to be sequenced. Now, at the time, nobody had ever sequenced that number of genomes. And if you ask the politicians now, why 100,000, they say, well, it was a good round number, which is a bit scary. And even more scarily, nobody at the time thought that it was possible. So it was an edge of science project. And the idea was not only to sequence all these genomes, but to gather all the health data associated with the genomes, and information about that person's condition and treatment. So it was both, so you've got the sequence data, then you've got the longitudinal data, which was the whole of the life course, and you've got information about that person's condition. And it was for mostly children with rare disease, and it was for people with cancer. And the idea was not, you would not only do that, but you would bust it into the NHS so that it would be part of the NHS. It would become business as usual. And that in itself was extraordinarily difficult. And we were the first country in the world to even attempt such a thing. And we're still the only country in the world, as far as I'm aware, that has a whole a genomic medicine service available as routine healthcare. So there are quite a lot of countries that offer genomics in various sorts, but we are the only country that have a genomic medicine service. And so the one thing that it made possible was this genomic medicine service. It's made diagnosis possible for a lot of people who went into the project with no diagnosis for their rare disease. So there are about, probably 10,000 or more rare diseases, and they're individually rare, but they're collectively common. And there are lots of people who go on this thing called a diagnostic odyssey, and they go from pillar to post, and everybody says there's something not quite right that's causing this, that, and the other symptom, but we don't know what it is. And what they used to do before the advent of the genomic medicine service was they effectively had to guess. So they would think, oh, it might be this, test you for that. It wasn't that. So they'd have to test you for something else. Wasn't that, send you off for more tests. And these kids would go for years and years and years without finding what was wrong. And about 25-30% of the people who came into the project were given a diagnosis as a result of the project. And these were all people who had had no explanation at all for their symptoms. And that's made a huge difference to many people. For some people, it's just knowing, which is important. Nothing you can do, but at least you know. And also, of course, you can test other people in the family to see if they've got that same condition. But for other people, it was absolutely life-changing because it meant that they could have a completely different treatment from the one that they were getting. I mean, I always remember a little girl right at the very beginning of the project, and she had masses and masses of seizures every day. Nobody could find out what was wrong with her. And eventually it was worked out that she had this rare change in her genetic code. And knowing what that change was meant that she was given a type of diet called a ketogenic diet. It's a very, very high fat diet. And actually that reduced her numbers of seizures enormously. And actually, had she had that diagnosis right at the very beginning, it would have meant she could have gone to normal school. She wouldn't have had the damage that she acquired through all those huge numbers of seizures and all the medicines she was taking. So it would have radically changed her life. And so here we are 10 years after the 100,000 Genomes Project, and we're just about to start at Genomics England, a newborn screening service using whole genome sequencing called the Generation Study. And it'll start at the end of this year to find, to see if we can find kids who are not diagnosed early and give them the treatment which will modify their disease, not cure it necessarily, but allow them to live their best lives.
That sounds incredible. And the ethical considerations of working with the genomes of newborns must be fairly significant.
It's always really difficult because when you work with genomes, you're not working with an individual's genomes, you're working with their family's genomes. And that brings a whole other level of concern. And you're also working in an area, I mean, genomics to me is another form of medicine, but you're working in an area of medicine which is freighted with cultural baggage. So I always say that, you know, that I remember reporting when the first draft of the human genome sequence was announced and, you know, saying it was going to revolutionize medicine by Tuesday tea time, as I ever did. But within 3 months of that launch, the first edition of a program you and I now know as CSI in its many, many formats appeared. And there have been something like 740 episodes since then. And I will tell you which has had more cultural impact on people's understanding of the genome, and that's CSI, which, you know, turn on your daytime telly anywhere in the world and it's on. So, you know, there are novels, there's movies, there's all sorts of things that come to us, you know, all those crime series that we see, everything. There are DNA procedurals, there are all sorts. So we've all got an idea in our mind of what we think sequencing our DNA might involve. And so people are really concerned, and particularly if you have a healthy baby, and we're asking you, as we would indeed, to keep that baby's data until they're 16 years old. So people can get worried about that, thinking, you know, what are they going to know about? And will they know stuff about my child that I don't know? And the answer to that is no, because we're only going to look for the things that we say that we're going to look for. But there are a mass of things. And it also extends to what conditions people want us to look for. So Genomics England did a huge amount of work with all sorts of different groups of people to find out what they thought. And they were very clear that they didn't want anything which was, you know, scary and had no treatment available for it. They got that, don't want to know. They wanted it to be conditions that appeared in childhood. They absolutely didn't want to know about conditions that appear in late life, like Alzheimer's, or you know, middle life, like breast cancer, for instance. But then that gives you a dilemma, because here's the thing: so we're only going to look for things that appear in a child's lifetime, that the childhood rather, that we can do something about. But how about if the baby has a change in their genome which puts them at risk of breast cancer in later life, like a BRCA2 variant, for instance? Well, we've said we're not going to look for stuff that appears later in life. But wouldn't it be terrible for a child if their mum died during their childhood from breast cancer? And if the child has breast cancer, then there's a good chance that the mum would have it too. So should you use sequencing a baby, screening a baby, in order to screen the mother on the basis that the mother being sick would cause damage to the child? And actually, we're not going to look for BRCA, but these things are not at all easy to get around.
Can you retest for or test for things that you maybe didn't want to test at the beginning of the child's life later on, if the genome's stored somewhere? Can you then come back like 10 years later and rescreen for some things?
Possibly, and now obviously with the consent of the parent. But one of the things that, of course, that taxes us is genomics has moved forward at an absolutely astonishing rate. I mean, I said that it would all change by Tuesday tea time, and it clearly didn't. It was 20 years between, you know, the sequence of the first sequence of the human genome and the start of Genomics England. But the pace of change since then has been absolutely astonishing. It's so fast. I mean, when you think that one of the big things that stopped us doing genomics was that every single genome cost $3 billion to sequence. Wow. And so you'd get, I worked out, you get 30 genomes for the entire NHS budget. And it was only because there was that combination of incredibly fast, high-speed computing allied with the rapid drop in the cost of genomic sequencing that allowed the 100,000 to take place in the first place. And now that drop in price is accelerating even more. So probably it's only about $100, $200 now to sequence a genome. And you can do it incredibly fast. I mean, don't quote me on that. I'm not going to. If you ask me for a genome for $200, I'm not the one to buy it from. but that's the kind of speed. And it's you then wonder whether it's actually even necessary to have a huge expense of storing in high security all this data, when actually for $100, you could just sequence again. Mm. So there are lots of things like that which are really up in the air still and undecided.
Yeah, and that would, if that's the case, that would help with some of the ethics of the data storage, like the privacy concerns that people will have. Maybe they'd be more likely to do it if they know that after they've done the testing, their data's deleted.
Yes, that's true. But of course, you know, we've seen it from UK Biobank and all the other cohort studies that actually having that data there has meant huge advances in what we're able to understand from genomics. So you need, it's both and. You need to have some data from quite a lot of people in order to find out all you can about the genome. I mean, you wouldn't be able to give people a genomic test were it not for the research that has been done on large quantities of genomic data in the first place.
Mm, it might be a case of something like we do now with donating our bodies to science or giving our organs for transplants. It's a kind of a nice thing to do with something that you have.
Yeah. My mother donated her body to science, and I always I always remember asking her why she did that. And she said, well, I've done it, dear, because I smoke 40 cigarettes a day. I drink rather a lot of gin. That was a bit of an understatement. I drink rather a lot of gin every day. And they'll want to know why I've lived to be 80 on gin and cigarettes. And actually, when she died, the local university to which she donated her body was full up. And so we had to find somewhere else. And eventually Cambridge University, thank you very much, Cambridge, took her, the medical school. And I happened to meet the vice chancellor of Cambridge. And I recounted this tale. And he said, and I said, I wanted to thank you on behalf of my mother, because she always wanted to go to Cambridge University.
That's really nice.
Amazing.
I would quite like to donate my body to science, but I get the feeling that science just isn't going to want it. You know, they'll just take a look and go, nah, that's all right.
Well, if you also get to 80, then that'll be a medical wonder.
Yeah, I mean, God, if I make it to the end of the week, it's going to be pretty special. So you mentioned that the cost of sequencing has like reduced massively from billions to hundreds. And one technology that must be helping that, I assume, is artificial intelligence. And, you know, could you tell us a bit about how that's maybe playing a role in making the future genomics possible?
So AI does make the future genomics possible. And I think it's very interesting because you've got the ethics of AI and you've got the ethics of genomics, but actually nobody's thought about what will happen or what are the ethics when you have genomics and AI together. And I think there are a lot of issues, which I hope I'm going to talk about it at Datalab. I mean, you're using AI, for instance, to understand the non-coding portions of the human genome. So just to explain, so when they went to do the first sequence of the human genome, everybody guessed that there would be 100,000 genes, 150,000 genes. Genes, remember, are the bits that are the specific instructions. And actually, we've got around just over 20,000 genes, the same as a starfish. So we're really not that special. And actually, the genes only account for less than 5%, much less than 5% of our genome. So what's all that other DNA doing? And that other DNA is the non-coding bit. What Jim Watson used to call junk DNA. But clearly it has a purpose, and AI is used to understand that non-coding portion using a technique called deep matrix factorization. Don't please quiz me anymore on my knowledge of deep matrix factorization ends after I've said deep matrix factorization. But also, I think you really get into difficulties when you're using AI to make medically actionable distinctions on the basis of genotype. So you're asking AI to tell you what it thinks the genome means. And there are a lot of issues about that, because you can't ever look at a genome and say, this is what's going to happen. It's not a crystal ball. Your genome is dynamic. It interacts with your environment. Your environment and how you live and what you do is constantly putting things like post-it notes onto your genome, which is altering its instructions. You know, instead of make this, it says make double this, or make triple of this and less of that. So, or make it at a different time. So your environment is altering the instructions. So how can you be sure that, without knowing everything you know about what's called the phenotype, but so what you can just observe from people, how can AI from the genotype predict what's going to happen? And I think it's, and then you get into the whole kind of black boxness of AI. How's it made that decision? If I tell you, you obviously can't see me, but I have a BMI of 21, which I've had all my life, and I was really skinny as a child and was called Stick. I have every deleterious variant going, and I should be the size of a house with type 2 diabetes and, you know, high blood pressure, all the rest of it. I haven't got that, but what is it that's in my environment? I mean, I'm a terrible fidget. I run around a lot. I eat masses of, you know, I'm hungry as a horse all the time. So there's a whole load of other things, both in your genome and in your environment, that are altering how that instruction on obesity is played out. So that becomes really, really difficult. And then I guess another thing that AI can do is interpret. So increasingly, you'll come back and your genome will be sequenced, or bits of your genome, and your GP or, you know, a clinician in, I don't know, a kidney specialist or a heart specialist will be faced with a whole load of genomic data, and they'll just be going, help, I've got no idea what this means. And increasingly, I think you'll see AI-powered chatbots. And there are a couple of companies in the US. There's a company called Clear Genetics. There's another company called GeneFacts. And they help interpret those reports for clinicians. But they've got to be absolutely transparent about how they do that, because it's not like buying insurance. You know, these things can have dramatic impacts on your life as to how the results are interpreted. So you've got to have that access to find out how that transparency, and it's got to be regulated.
Yeah, I suppose if there are just even some small inaccuracies and someone ends up taking the wrong medicine or not acting on something that they could have done and then prevented a problem, the legal cases could be huge as well for companies doing these things.
There's such a lot here.
Mm-hmm. And the data that you'd have to train those AI chatbots on would have to be so diverse to make sure that you're capturing.
Of course, that's a huge area, because a lot of the data is white European, and people are increasingly, I mean, there's a horrible phrase, admixed. In other words, so, you know, mixed marriages are extremely common now. And what do all these admixed genes mean? I mean, to your health? I mean, nobody has a clue, I suspect.
We've been learning recently about epigenetics and how...
Yeah, that's my post-it note.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's such a fascinating thing, because it's kind of settled the nature versus nurture debate. And the answer is, like, it's both. You know, it's not just what you're born with. It's the environments that you're raised in and the experiences you have in life. And if these AIs don't take that into consideration, then people who come from disadvantaged backgrounds or, you know, poor socioeconomic environments, they're going to get horrendous advice. Maybe I'm just inherently, I don't trust AI enough yet, but if I went to the doctor and he or she said, just give me a second, they're going to ask this chatbot what medicine to give you, I wouldn't be like over the moon. Given that I can ask ChatGPT, like, what's 2 times 4, and it'll give me a dozen wrong answers.
I think what you are going to see, I would say quite soon in the NHS, is you'll see pharmacogenomics. So pharmacogenomics is where you look at your genome and it helps you understand which medicines will work best for you. So, you know, there's a very common medicine that's given, is a cardiovascular medicine, and about a third of people it will have absolutely no effect on. And there's a disproportionate number of that third who have an Asian heritage. So, you know, finding out somebody's pharmacogenomics is really important so that they're given the right medicines. And that's a fairly easy thing to do, relatively speaking. I mean, the mechanism of how you do it is terribly complicated. But, you know, the pharmacogenomics, it exists. You know, and who wouldn't want to know that, for instance, they metabolized pain meds so quickly that actually you won't get any pain relief from them. And that's about 1 in 8 of us. Whereas, you know, somebody else may metabolize them really slowly, and so they'll be overdosed. So, you know, who wouldn't want a kind of traffic light system that tells us what medicines, what dosage of medicines we ought to be having? I mean, that would be really useful. But some of the big decisions about, you know, what you should be doing in terms of your preventive health, if the AI is wrong and hasn't taken all this thing in, all these other things into consideration. And it's not just having the genetic information, it's having the environmental information, it's having the phenotypic information. It's, you know, so there are a load of things together, and I don't think we're anywhere near getting that all in order.
I think people will love it if we can not only do that with what medicines we should be taking, but also with things like diet, like what diet is going to be the best for my particular genetic makeup.
You see, now there is quite a lot of that already. And I have to say that I am deeply suspicious about quite a lot of it, because I think a lot of it is about marketing. And I think folks just eat what you like, not too much, not too much meat, lots of plants, you'll be fine. Yeah, when people start going down, you know, this is your genomic diet, I think this is not a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I can say as a marketer that as soon as marketing people get involved, it's generally bad news. Just we make everything a little bit worse. So I'd be gutted if I, you know, went for one of those tests and found that, I don't know, I'm genetically not supposed to eat pasta. Then I'd starve.
Oh.
I don't know what I would eat if I didn't have that.
When we were talking about the epigenetics, the post-it notes on particular parts of your DNA, I was wondering, when you look at the genome, can you tell what's an epigenetic change versus what was something that was already there before the environmental impact on the DNA?
From the Wikipedia article I read, the epigenetic change doesn't change the sequence itself, it changes the way the gene is expressed. So you'd be able to see the original sequence, but it's just the way it's expressed.
So your sequence, you were born with your genetic sequence, you died with the same genetic sequence. And it's like you've got this huge recipe book, and, you know, on every page, there's a whole load of notes from your mum in the margin saying, you know, you need half a bite more water in this one. You know, that's the way to think about epigenetics, I think. So it doesn't actually change the wording. It's still there, but it will change how you interpret a particular recipe.
I might be wrong here, but can it change gametes when epigenetic changes are passed on over generations? I've heard things about, like, a few generations back there being a famine. So
Dutch famine during the war, most famous of all, Audrey Hepburn, who was born, or whose mother was she was pregnant during that period. So yes, there are lots of things about people that you can, certain epigenetic marks you take from one generation to the next. And why they said that about the Dutch famine was because the babies who were born to those mothers who were starved were small, as you might expect, in born from women who were starved. But that the next generation were also small. And so the thought was that it had been passed from generation to generation. There's quite a lot of dispute in this area about how much is actually transferred from one generation to another. It's not my field, so I wouldn't venture an opinion, but it's a place that you get a lot of arguing.
It would be really interesting if one day we actually can definitively say that your environment and behavior will affect your kids and grandkids, because I wonder if that would make people reconsider. I mean, I owe my daughter an apology, you know, because if I'd known any of this.
I would say no, because I just think that's, you can't live your life, really. I mean, teenagers, it's their duty to be irresponsible. that's what they need. They need to press every boundary. And, you know, you wouldn't want to say to teenagers, you may not do this because it's going to affect future generations. That's an unfair burden, I think, to place on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think it would be especially, it would fall on the shoulders of women more often than not. Yeah. You know,
it would become a way of controlling people through like guilting them and shaming them about babies that don't exist yet and might not ever exist.
You've already seen.
Coming to our world.
Yeah, yeah. There's already so many people who like try to get, you know, sterilized and can't, you know, especially in America, because say, oh, what if your future husband wants kids? Yeah. You know, you're being beholden to a person you've never met for a child that may never exist. If we can prove the sort of epigenetic approach, then that might just get worse.
Mm.
Maybe we could just stop looking. Just assume DNA works. It's cool. Let's leave it be. You know, it's like planes. Yes. Exactly. It's like airplanes. I don't need to know how they work to know that it's neat. With that said, I think now it might be time for some wild speculation.
In each episode of The Last Question, we ask our guests to look beyond the scope of their research and speculate wildly about the future. Vivian, what do you think will be the biggest advancement in genomic research over the next 50 years?
Well, I am absolutely the very last person to ask about speculation. As a presenter of Tomorrow's World, which is that iconic BBC television show that anybody over the age of about 45 will remember. If you're under 45, just ignore the next bit. But I was always asked to predict what would happen in the future. And I got it spectacularly wrong more times than I got it right. There are some things that I did. You may remember I did a film about the mouse with a human ear on its back, which went all around the world. And actually, that wasn't really about equipping mice with ears. It was about tissue engineering. And that was the beginning of tissue engineering, which has become a big thing now. But there were other things. I mean, famously, electric cars. Because at Tomorrow's World, we said over the course of the program's history, for 30 years, that there would be electric cars in 3 to 5 years on every corner. And clearly, we're not even there yet. So we have to have all sorts of other things in place, like electric cars, the things that stop us having electric cars. And the first one of those, by the way, appeared in about 1895. The thing that stopped us having electric cars was the infrastructure. And so I think with genomics, what may constrain genomics, and rightly, is what people think, what people want, and what society wants to use genomics for. So I think that the technology will always outrun in genomics people's willingness to engage or know what their genome holds. Because I think that genomics, to some extent, you know, for all that I've been in genomics all my life, for all that it's seen as a crystal ball, actually, there's so much more involved in your future than genomics.
I like that as a sentence.
Yeah.
We'd
like to thank Vivian for joining us today for that really, really interesting exploration of genomics and epigenetics and the future of our genomic sequence. You can see Vivian in person at the 2023 edition of Data Summit, the Data Lab's flagship conference right in the middle of DataFest. This year's Data Summit is back at the EICC in Edinburgh on the 2nd and 3rd of November 2023. You can get an exclusive 25% off your in-person and live stream tickets with the code DS23TLQ. That's all caps. So head over to datafest.global for tickets and information. We've had an amazing response to our episode with Paolo Bonanti, advisor to Pope Francis and the Vatican on matters of AI and technology ethics, and lots of interesting responses to the question we posed, how will AI affect faith in the future?
One such fascinating response was from David Chart, a naturalized Japanese citizen who passed the highest level of Jinja Kentei, an examination on Shinto offered to lay people by Jinja Honcho, the most important and on most measures the largest Shinto organization in Japan. David provided a really interesting insight into how AI may affect Shinto in the future.
So we'll read a few sections from his response here. And if you're interested in Shinto, definitely check out his website, mimusubi.com. That's mimusubi.com. So on AI, David said, and I quote, "Shinto does not draw, and as far as I'm aware, never has drawn, sharp distinctions between kami, the objects of veneration in Shinto tradition, people, other living things, and the inanimate world. There are jinja that venerate Mount Fuji, and some people believe that the kami is literally the mountain, not the spirit of the mountain. Thus, no matter how much AI might seem to blur the line between inanimate objects and conscious beings, that will not bother Shinto, because we never really had that line in the first place. This means that the development of AI does not present any fundamental problems for Shinto."
David continued to say, "Could an AI be venerated as a kami? Possibly. There is a jinja that venerates an explicitly fictional character from a 1,000-year-old Japanese novel. This would be unlikely to happen with an active AI, but could happen with one that had been deactivated. Could an AI become a Shinto priest? Possibly, although it would need to be embodied in a humanoid robot to perform the ceremonies. I'm sure that this would be controversial, but I'm also sure that there would be at least one jinja that would allow it. Could an AI visit a jinja and offer prayers? I would imagine so. Shinto places no restrictions on who may come, and if artificially intelligent robots become able to visit jinja, priests are very unlikely to try to stop them. The general policy is that anyone is welcome, no matter what their race, gender, or religion, and that would easily extend to AI. I can imagine this being less controversial than the priesthood, because it would be easiest just to allow it."
David finished off by saying, "Will AI be used as a tool within Shinto practice? Almost certainly, and the details of what is acceptable will be worked out as we go along, probably through vigorous debate. Shinto has over 1,500 years of history of adapting its traditions and practices to a changing society. The development of AI systems seems sure to require further adaptation, but the questions it raises are some of the same sort as those raised by industrialization and urbanization, rather than fundamental challenges to the tradition as a whole." End quote. That was really, really interesting. Mm. I really like the thing about a deactivated AI becoming an object of veneration. Mm. Like, that's so cool. Like, this kind of, you know, dead gods that people look back on and venerate but not worship.
I think I'm going to think about this quite a lot, especially things like the boundary between animate and inanimate.
Mm-hmm.
Inanimate and in... Hang on. Animate.
And inanimate.
And inanimate. Yeah, you can just edit that, so... Yep. Because I think we don't really... The boundary is quite hard in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be really interesting to learn more about the blurred boundary between animate and inanimate.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting stuff. We'd like to thank David for his insights into AI and Shinto. The best part of doing this podcast is hearing so many fascinating perspectives that I never would have thought of. And as always, if you want to write in, just email datafest@thedatalab.com. And we'd love to hear your thoughts.
And here we are, the last question. This is where we pose our listeners a question, and in a future episode, we'll discuss some of the most interesting answers. Our question this week is, what are the most exciting medical advancements we're going to see over the next 50 years?
So that's it from us today. We'll be back next time with more insight, innovation, and wild speculation. Please feel free to drop us an email to say hello, suggest a topic, correct us, we love that. You can find us at datafest@thedatalab.com.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a review on your platform of choice. It goes a long way and means a lot to us. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time for another episode of The Last Question. Goodbye. All my world is yours, glass cloud tonight.